rather interesting, Mr. Armstrong, talking about, you know, war and the strife in the world today. Because 2,500 years ago, another man was asking the same questions, which is rather interesting. Some years ago, I gave a sermon on Habakkuk. So what I'd like to do today is revisit Habakkuk. So we can call it Habakkuk Revisited, for those who like titles. First of all, who was he? Well, quite frankly, he doesn't tell us. But if we dig a little bit, we can find some clues. First of all, he was obviously a prophet. He was quite a well-educated man. The whole book is actually a psalm, and very skillfully constructed psalm, according to the experts. One of the experts says, quote, "The book abounds in striking expressions and rare words. The book is remarkable also in its originality. The author departs from the usual method of the prophets. In their addresses to the nation in their addresses, the nation is central. In Habakkuk's, it's God and his government of the world." Which is interesting. The style of the book has been praised by many scholars, suggesting that its author was a man of great literary talent. Take a bit of an exception to that, because you know what? Habakkuk wrote the words down. The words came from Jesus Christ, who is fairly well educated, I think. So you can see that the man basically wrote it down, as with so many of the other prophets. But there's a few more clues. There in chapter 3, we're told it said to the chief singer on my stringed instruments. Now, the Jewish Encyclopedia explains that he was a Levite has been based on the strength of the postscript to chapter 3, verse 19. It's on my stringed instruments, which indicates that he owned the instruments. Only a Levite was authorized to use an instrument to accompany his songs in the temple. And one of the commentaries mentions, some have deduced that final statement of the book for the choir director on my stringed instruments may indicate that he was also a Levite and a member of the temple choir, or that he was in some way connected with the temple worship in Jerusalem. We may also assume with confidence that he was a prophet in the southern kingdom of Judah, and he very likely lived in Jerusalem. So we know a little bit about him. All we need to know is that he was a prophet, and it's not the man that's important, it's the message. And that is the same today in our age with Mr. Armstrong. People have accused us of worshipping Mr. Armstrong. No, it's the message that Christ got to the church through him that's important. Now, I think let's first start off with looking at the world in which Habakkuk lived, because it was kind of like different. It was different in some ways, but it was probably one of the most interesting periods in world history. In a little over 100 years, we went through 3 world empires. We started off with the Assyrian Empire. Along came the Babylonians. They rose and fell. And then, of course, then they were replaced by the Persians, the Medo-Persians. So this was quite an active 150 years or so of world history. Now, the 600s, between the fall of Israel and the fall of Judah, then the commentators tell us the Mayan civilization was riding very high in the Mexico area. Aesop's fables were written, if you can remember some of those from school days. New religions abounded. We had Confucius, we had Buddha, Zoroaster, the Jewish prophets, the Greek poets, artists, philosophers, scientists. The 6th century BC reaches a zenith of human wisdom and achievement. It also reached the zenith of wars. Many, many, many wars. Pythagoras is said to have introduced the octave in music. Very interesting. Poor old Darwin thought he invented the theory of evolution. But you know what? Anaximander taught that all life developed from amphibians way back then. Obviously, green slime hadn't yet, come into the public eye. But it was also a time of upheaval and change. In this period, we see the fall of the Assyrian Empire, followed by the rise of Babylon. Babylon, from being a mere province of Assyria to becoming an empire, took less than 30 years. Babylon burst onto the scene, and suddenly, similar to the end time beast power, to those who are not watching, it will appear suddenly. Mr. Armstrong, in a co-worker letter in November 1982, said, "Events I have foreseen, proclaimed over the air and published in the plain truth for about 48 years, are at last suddenly falling into place. the gigantic new world power, the United States of Europe, the resurrection of the medieval Holy Roman Empire, is about to blossom into almost unbelievable reality. A few years out, yeah, but the message is right. Now, going back to 631, that's when Babylon revolted. That's when Babylon became into the public eye, just. They were a small province of Assyria. No great shakes. After the death of the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, the Babylonians revolted against their Assyrian governors. 626, coming down, the Babylonians defeated an Assyrian army. 612, the Babylonians destroyed Nineveh. Now they're getting a bit more powerful. 606, King Necho of Egypt invades Judah. And then 605, now listen to this. 605, Nebuchadnezzar, the crown prince, defeats the Egyptian army of Necho. 605. Later on, in August 605, Nabopolassar dies, the king. Nebuchadnezzar becomes king in April 604. And what does he do? Straight into Judah. Straight into Judah. You see how sudden that was for those people? They had no idea what hit them. They had no idea what hit them. That's the first Babylonian invasion. You read about that in 2 Kings 24. I mean, you have Daniel. You need to turn there. I'll just read it just because you know this quite well. Daniel 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, into Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Daniel, then you get Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego all taken down to Babylon. Interesting to note, verse 2, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. God did it. And this is something that I think we is becoming more and more obvious recently. We're seeing that a lot of these things, God actually did it. It didn't just happen. Now, Jehoiakim, king of Judah, continued to rule until 595, and he slept with his fathers, and of course that was the year that the second Babylonian invasion took place. There were three in all, and in 585 we get the third one. Jeremiah 52, we can turn there, I think, because we need to read this. Jeremiah 52. Verse 10, and the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. He slew all the princes of Judah in Riblah. And then he put out the eyes of Zedekiah, he blinded him. And the king of Babylon bound him in chains and carried him to Babylon and put him in prison till he died. Do you know the horrible thing? This should not have happened. This could have been totally avoided. Jeremiah 38. Go back to Jeremiah 38. And verse 6. You know, poor old Jeremiah, he had a tough time. The princes didn't like him. The king sort of liked him. And it was a constant battle to keep him alive. And they eventually got him and they chucked him down in the cesspit. Right? Up to his armpits in... Yeah. Not nice. They lowered him down in ropes. And verse 8 of Jeremiah 38 says, and in the dungeon there was no water but mire. So Jeremiah sunk into the mire. And in verse 12 of Jeremiah 38, then Edom Melech of the Ethiopian said to Jeremiah, this is where he gets rescued. He said, now put these cloths and rags under your armholes, under the cords. And Jeremiah did so, and they actually pulled him out. Now, that must have been quite some job. That's why they put the cloth under his arm. The ropes were ripped to pieces. Getting somebody out of a mess like that it would be quite nasty. Now, drop down to verse 17. Here's something which, we read over these things, and suddenly the lights start flashing. Then said Jeremiah to Zedekiah, now he's obviously been cleaned up and brought before the king. Thus says the Lord of God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you will assuredly go forth, now bearing in mind the army was like outside. If you will surely go forth unto the king of Babylon's princes, then your soul shall live, and this city shall not be burned with fire, and you shall live along with your house. If he had done what he was told, history would have been vastly different. But if you will not go forth to the king of Babylon's princes, then this city shall be given unto the hand of the Chaldeans, and they shall burn it with fire, and you will not escape out of their hand. He was warned. He would not obey, and the result is now history. And why? Verse 19. Here we go. And Zedekiah the king said to Jeremiah, I am afraid of the Jews that are fallen to the Chaldeans, lest they deliver me into their hand, and they mock me. In other words, some of the Jews already were imprisoned by the Babylonians, and he felt that if he was imprisoned with them, they would make his life pretty miserable. Very sad. So he died. Jerusalem was destroyed. God's temple was destroyed. All because he didn't do what he was told. I just noticed that when I was doing the study for this sermon. And I thought, wow, you know, isn't that amazing? If he'd done what he was told, Jerusalem and the temple would not have been destroyed. History would have been completely different. So, there's a lesson there. At this time, Jeremiah takes the king's daughters and continues the royal line by going across to Ireland. And, of course, you get that in the GB and US and GB in prophecy. Now, here's a little bit of the horrible history. Somebody asked me this a while back. What's the difference between Chaldeans and Babylonians? Because the Bible uses the two terms together. The Chaldeans were a tribe of Semites from southern Babylonia who, under the leadership of Nabopolassar, became rulers of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. This implies a time prior to their rise to power, which came after the critical battle of Carchemish in 605 BC. You see, they really only really made it 605. Judah was taken captive 604. This happened, like, quickly. Bearing in mind there was no internet, no telephones, no TV. The news would be delivered by a man either running like, you know, or a donkey. Maybe he had a horse. You know. When Nelson won the Battle of Trafalgar, it took 3 weeks for the news to get to England. You know, we forget it. We just pick our mobile phone up now and he's there. Before this time, the Babylonians were not really a world force to be reckoned with. This is why the Lord tells Habakkuk, quote, look among the nations, observe, be astonished and wonder. I am doing something in your days that you would not believe, even if it were told. We'll come to that in a minute. It seems that Habakkuk wrote sometime in the last few years before the Babylonians actually attacked Jerusalem. This all happened, you know, one thing after the other. Now, the Chaldeans would seem to be the religious lot, shall we call them. God's word's pretty scathing about the Chaldeans. Just to make a note of Isaiah 47, verse 1. It says, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground. There's no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. And you just read over that and you think, yeah, that's right. We know what's going on. We're going to go to, you know, we'll end up in Revelation in a minute, won't we? We will, yes. Think carefully. Who was Isaiah? He was a prophet that prophesied to Israel before Israel went into captivity. That was 130 years before the Jews went into captivity. And he's already nailing the Chaldeans. The Babylonians, the Chaldeans, didn't come into power until almost right before they attacked Jerusalem. This is another one of these things like calling Cyrus God's servant 100-odd years before Cyrus was even born. Say, we read over these things, but you know, it's right here. Daughter of the Chaldeans. And the Chaldeans, as I say, weren't really anything on the world scene until right before the fall of Judah. Now we have the founder of the Catholic Church. You need to turn to Acts 8. We know all about Simon Magus, the sorcerer. A continuation of this Babylonian way, this Chaldean way. He bewitched them with sorceries. And of course, then you've got to go to Revelation 17, verse 3. Let's turn there. This is stuff that's going to be fulfilled very, very shortly. Revelation 17 and verse 3. when I read Revelation, I always feel so sorry for the Apostle John, because he was given insight into things that he would not have understood what was going on, really. I'd say the fastest thing he would know would be a donkey running downhill with a load on his back. Suddenly he's getting, looking into our day with all the, all the wonderful technology we have for killing each other. Revelation 17, verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Not much of an accolade, is it? So, these are the Babylonians. That's the religion. Point to keep in mind, which is interesting. God sent the Assyrians to take Israel captive. God sent the Babylonians to take the Jews captive. And very shortly, we're going to get the Assyrians ridden and controlled by the Babylonians to sort out the end time problem, aren't we? Think about it. Right. God, this plan, this working, being worked out here below, is all laid out. It's all laid out. Introduction to the message of Habakkuk is short and to the point. Let's just turn to Habakkuk. Verse 1, chapter 1. It simply says, this is the message that the prophet Habakkuk received in a vision. This I'm reading from the New English Translation. I think it just makes it a little bit easier to understand. Now, we know that he was a Levite linked possibly to the temple choir, and he was obviously a fairly well-educated man, and so on. But Christ himself would have composed that prophecy. Now, let's just read the first few verses, down to verse 4. And think, how are you feeling right now? If you read last night's news, and the news the night before, and the news the night before, this is a man who was writing 2,500 years ago, no TV, no radio, no internet, no mobile phones. Here's what he says. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you don't listen? Violence is everywhere. I cry, but you do not come to save. Must I forever see these evil deeds? Why must I watch all this misery? Wherever I look, I see destruction and violence. I am surrounded by people who love to argue and fight. The law has become paralyzed, and there is no justice in the courts. The wicked far outnumber the righteous, so that justice has become perverted. You know, you feel like clapping. And yet, that is exactly what we are doing now, isn't it? Where's justice? Where is justice? Look at the American system at the moment with the president. The president's trying to govern the country, and half the country's trying to undermine him. And in the end, after digging around for years, they come up with the fact that, oh, well, there wasn't really anything there in the first place. And they immediately find something else to try and clobber him with. Very few trials in the States actually go to trial, because they have this plea bargaining system, which I've never fully understood. You admit that you're guilty and you get a reduced sentence. Saves all the time in the courts. No justice. No justice. He's a very human prophet. He was watching for the soon coming Babylonian army and the capture of Jerusalem. That's what he was watching. He couldn't see it. He couldn't see. Oh, they were making noises. They had an army and there'd been a few scraps. And Nineveh had been destroyed. But to come and trash Jerusalem? But he'd been told it was going to happen. He was watching for it. We're told to watch. We're told to watch events in the light of prophecy. We're told to watch the rise of Germany. We're told to watch the Catholic Church. We're told to look at trade wars and so on. But there's something else that we are to watch. God wants to see a reaction from us. And turn to Ezekiel 9. So this is something we've read quite a lot, but it bears repeating. Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 4. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, talking about Jerusalem, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men who sigh and who cry for all the abominations, all the disgusting practices, the hateful things, the sin that is being done in the midst thereof. Put a mark on them. Why? We'll see in a minute. This is why we watch the news, and it's mostly all bad or sad. Very, very rarely do you get something that raises a chuckle. I think recently the one that I don't think I actually put on the news. I thought it was a bit too way out. But evidently there's some gentleman somewhere who's going to sue his parents for allowing him to be born without his permission. Yeah. Can you say anything in response to that? Oh, dear, dear. Romans 1. We needn't turn there. I'm just going to refer to it because we know Romans 1 very well. This is a prophecy of today. The people, they think it's foolish to even consider God. Their lives are full of every kind of wickedness, sin, greed, hate, envy, murder, quarreling, deception, malicious behavior and gossip, backstabbers, haters of God, insolent, proud, boastful. They invent new ways of sinning, then they disobey their parents, they refuse to understand, break their promises, are heartless and have no mercy. Boom. Read the news. Read the news. They know God's justice. Verse 32 of Romans 1. They know God's justice requires that those who do such things deserve to die, yet they do them anyway. Worse yet, they encourage others to do them also. Welcome to our world. Welcome to the 21st century. We can see this in action every day. We see God's laws being broken. We see the pain. We see the suffering. We see the strife. We see the chaos. We see the confusion. And that people are suffering as a result. All round the world. Over 100 million people died last year in wars. 100 million. That's almost double the population of Britain. A third of the population of America. Around the world. Slaughtered in wars. We live in a world where people think there can be any sex they want. And such as male and female. They've got 50 different varieties now. And then people would say, if I said this in public, they would accuse me of being crazy. Who's crazy? God made male and female. That was it. Nice and plain, nice and simple. But now they've got all sorts of things. Their minds are completely perverted, because the God of this world, his mind is also completely perverted. How crazy is mankind, right? Think about this. To live, we need air. We need oxygen. We need preferably clean air. We need clean water. We need food that's grown properly in the soil, that contains all the minerals and the nourishment that we need to keep a healthy body. We pollute the air, we pollute the water, and in the process, our food has become foodless, because out of greed, we've A, grown it on ground that's dead and filled it full of chemicals, then we pull it out the ground and we spray more, well, while it's in growing, we spray it with chemicals. We then take it out the ground and put more chemicals in it, stick it in plastic bags and sell it. We call it food. And every so often they come up and say, oh, you mustn't eat that stuff. That it's carcinogenic, actually. Terribly sorry. Try this one. We're out of our heads as a race of people. People looking back at this era are going to scratch their heads and say, how did any of you guys survive? How did any of you survive? I read a report this morning. There's some mines in America pumping millions of gallons of nasty water into the local river. Downstream, they take the water out and they process it and people drink it. And some cities, the sewers reprocessed and people drink it. Shouldn't be that way. You read about the millennium. What do you read about? Lakes, streams, rivers, all over the place. Fresh water, full of fish. That's what God designed it for. The water was put there as a food source, as a life source. No water, no life. They've just found water on Mars. Therefore, there must have been life there. Right. Again, wonky reasoning. They've got to justify the fact that they found something, because they've now found that Neptune has got another satellite going around it, another moon. So now we've got to go to Neptune now and take photographs of that moon. So important. And 5 million people in America are sleeping in their cars because they can't even afford a house. We have the opportunity to assist Christ in changing all this mess. That's why we're here. We sigh and we cry for all the abominations, the disgusting practices, the hateful things, the stupidity, the sin, the suffering. Why? To show God that we are starting to think like He does. That's the key. We're starting to think like He does. We're going above the human sort of reasoning. How does God feel? They can prove it. We're told in Luke 17:26, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. Right, we know that. Now, go to Genesis 6. Let's just see how God feels about Noah. Genesis 6, verse 5. Remember, this is Christ we're talking about here, the Word, as He was then. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great upon the earth, and that every imagination of his thoughts of his heart were evil continually. Just like today. See the latest game you can now get your kids on online? Got a little character there that actually tries to get your kid to commit suicide. And the threat is that if you don't do what I say, I'll come in the night and I'll kill you while you sleep. Aimed at children 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. Just when the mind is starting to, you know, get working. Lovely world. Pity about the people. And God saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart were evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. It grieved him. Think about it. That's his attitude. He was sighing and crying for all the abominations that he saw on the earth. As a result, he destroyed virtually everything except Noah, his family, and the contents of the ark. All destroyed. Right now, God is sighing and crying for all the abominations that he sees in the land now. Think about that one. But right now, the solution is going to be somewhat different. Christ is waiting ready for the Father to say, right, set the end time process, the final part of the end time process, set it into action. Are we seeing it? Are we seeing it? We see in the news, as you saw in the update, about the fact that Germany is rearming. They've got soldiers fighting in 6 or 7 different nations of the world. They're selling high-tech armaments to the rest of the world. But meanwhile, their army's under-equipped. Their weapons don't work. It's really terrible salesmanship. In other words, they're trying to tell us we're not a threat. We really are not a threat. We're still really pacifists, really. We know different. We were told there'd be Nazis at the end time. We've got them there. Third biggest party in the German parliament. Start back in verse 1 again, because it ties into what comes in verse 5. Habakkuk, now we go back to the book. This is the message that the prophet Habakkuk received in a vision. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Violence is everywhere. I cry, but you don't come to save. Must I forever see these evil deeds? Why must I watch all this misery? Wherever I look, I see destruction and violence. I'm surrounded by people who love to fight and argue. The law has become paralyzed. There is no justice in the courts. The wicked far outnumber the righteous, so that justice has become perverted. And he stamps his foot. I'm fed up. What does God say? Verse 5. Look around at the nations. Look and be amazed. For I am doing, not I'm going to, I am doing something in your own day, something you wouldn't believe even if someone told you about it. It's rather interesting. You just make a note, Acts 13:41. Paul quotes Habakkuk 1:5 in Acts 13:41, and that's only a very few years before the destruction of Jerusalem. In fact, let's just turn there, because it's actually quite interesting. See, we've got to remember, in this day and age where we've got all the Bibles, we've got the Bible on the computer, we can search, we can dig around, we can find anything we want in seconds. In those days, they had to memorize it. So when Christ was talking to the Jews, or Paul was talking to the Jews, they knew their Bible, their Old Testament. That's all they had, obviously. So Acts 13, verse 40. Beware, therefore, lest that come upon you which is spoken of in the prophets. Behold, you despisers, and wonder, and perish. For I work a work in your days, a work which you shall in no wise believe, though a man declare it unto you. And what did the Jews do? They got up in the huff and walked out. And when the Jews were gone out of the synagogue, the Gentiles besought that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. Why? Well, the Jews were angry because they were being reminded as to what happened back in 604 when their nation was taken captive by the Babylonians. They would know that. They would know what we're reading here in Habakkuk. See, I'm raising up the Babylonians. Verse 6. I am raising up the Babylonians, a cruel and violent people. They will march across the world and conquer other lands, which they did. How similar is that to today? Back in the time of Habakkuk, the Babylonians didn't seem like a threat. They burst suddenly onto the scene. In Paul's day, people were not expecting the destruction of Jerusalem. It all happened within a couple of years. Out of the blue, shall we say. But it happened suddenly. They had very little warning. Today, Germany, and the whole of Europe for that matter, is in utter chaos. No apparent threat to anyone but themselves. The European government seems about to fall, the main government in Brussels. Several nations want to dump the euro and get their own currency back. Greece, Italy, and believe it or not, Germany. More Germans, over 50% of Germans want the Deutsche Mark back. The other end time player, the Roman Catholic Church, is being dragged through the courts all over the world for people wanting compensation because they've been abused by priests. And in fact, the popes we've seen in the news has been involved in a big conference this last week. They're being sued for billions. Well, they've got billions as well. But they're being sued. So Germany is in a mess. The Catholic Church is in a mess. And yet, the message we've been given is that that Catholic Church, that Pope, will ride the beast, that European army. And it will be the end of Britain and America. And it'll be taking over the whole Middle East. And so I've got here, these two are going to get together and take over the Middle East and destroy both Britain and the most powerful nation in the world today, the United States of America. And soon. But it sure doesn't look like it now, does it? So many people have said, I've had people contact me and say, you know, you guys are talking about this and talking about that. You're nuts. It's at least 25 years in the future, 30 years in the future. Germany's a non-starter. Europe's this, Europe's that. America's all strong. 12 aircraft carrier squadrons. Very impressive, isn't it? Trouble is, I think 8 or 9 of them, the reactors are getting ready for being renewed because they are 30 or 40 years old and they can't afford to do it. So they might have 12 on paper, but could they get 12 into the sea? Could they get 12 into action? What happens if somebody like Iran get hold of one of these hypersonic missiles and just take out one of these aircraft carriers, cut it in half? Billions and billions of dollars, 6,000 odd American troops. Then what's going to happen? As I say, try telling this to people today, and be prepared to be laughed at. And yet, he says, I will work a work in your days which you will know, you would not believe even though it was told you. And then it says this message is for the end times, for now. It was for him then. It's also for us today. There's an article here that was building a new empire in Europe. While the British are tying themselves in knots of Gordian proportions over their leaving Europe, the leaders of Germany and France have been meeting now, laying the stage for their political domination of the European Union. In Europe, symbolism is all important, and Aachen was chosen to make a statement. It was there during the 9th century that Charlemagne, the king who united much of Western Europe into the Holy Roman Empire, made his home. Britain was never part of that empire. That's in the news now. They've already done this with a view to linking it with the Holy Roman Empire. Can we see it? Most people out there won't. Many people in God's church won't, because they're not awake. They're not watching. Here's what God's End Time Apostles said in 1965 regarding the resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. Events I have foreseen, proclaimed over the air and published in the plain truth for 48 years, are at last suddenly falling into place. The gigantic new world power, the United States of Europe, the resurrection of the medieval Holy Roman Empire is about to blossom into almost unbelievable reality. All right, it's a few years off. But again, we don't tag dates onto things. We look at the message. That's the message. Today in the news, we see them having a meeting in Aachen because that's symbolic of the fact that that's where the Holy Roman Empire was centered at the time. And also he wrote 50 years ago, in spite of Mr. Churchill's farsightedness, he could not foresee that this great politico-religio-economic power block of 10 nations would not only refuse Britain membership, that's in the final United States of Europe, the 10, but would ultimately prove the undoing of the Anglo-Saxon people of America, Britain, and the Commonwealth countries. Again, forget the day. That's the message. Back to Habakkuk, verse 7, chapter 1. They are notorious for their cruelty and do whatever they like. This is describing now the Babylonians. Their horses are swifter than cheetahs and fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their charioteers charge from far away. Like eagles, they swoop to devour the prey. On they come, all bent on violence. Their hordes advance like the desert wind, sweeping captives ahead of them like sand. They scoff at kings and princes and scorn all their fortresses. They simply pile up ramps of earth against their walls and capture them. They sweep past like the wind and are gone, but they are deeply guilty, for their own strength is their God. Now that was describing the Babylonians. Now turn to Isaiah 10. The number of parallels here is actually very, very, very interesting. God used the prophet Isaiah to warn the people about the Assyrians. At the end of the age, the attitude is unchanged. Isaiah 10, verse 5. O Assyrian! For many, many years, this was read as O Assyria. No, it's talking about a specific man. That doesn't necessarily mean he comes from Germany. But he will be an Assyrian. You know, Mr. Trump actually is only one stage removed from being German. I think his father was German. His father, his grandfather. There are 80 million people in America that claim German descent. Mr. Adolf Hitler was Austrian. But he will be an Assyrian. The rod of my anger. Yeah? My anger. This is somebody God's going to raise up. And the staff in their hand is my indignation. I will send him against a hypocritical nation and against the people of my wrath, and I will give him a charge to take the spoil and take the prey and tread them down like mire in the streets. Rule Britannia. Britons never, never, never shall be slaves. You've got to be careful about saying things like that. As a small child of about 7 years old, I think it was, I spent my first 7 years living in Port Talbot. My dad was working in the steelworks. And then we moved to England, to Yorkshire. Civilization. They spoke English up there. And I said to my parents, I don't ever, ever, ever want to go back to Wales. When we left Ambassador College closed and we went back to South Africa, and we stood at the stern of the boat and we watched England receding in the distance. You won't see me again. Bye. When I went to Ambassador College, I made it quite clear I wasn't there to become a minister. I wanted to be a photographer on the plain truth staff, which I achieved. Never wanted to be in the ministry. And there you go. You see, you don't ever say things like that because they come back to haunt you. Yeah, Britons never, never shall be slaves. Hmm. Verse 8 of Isaiah 10. He says, are not my princes altogether like kings? Shall I not, as I have done in Samaria, and your isles, do so to Jerusalem and her idols? It's always me, I, yeah? For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom. And my hand has found as a nest the riches of the people. Not realizing that God, in actual fact, was just simply using this man to correct his people. And then God punishes Assyria in verse 18. And he talks about, and they shall consume the glory of his forest. Germany's full of it. There are trees all over the place. It's some of the most beautiful forests in Europe. And he says, and I shall consume the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body. And they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. You know, in the old battle, you had the standard bearer. He had the standard. He had the flag. And he stood on a high point. And that's rallied the troops. That's where they knew where the commander was, and they were, you know, they were a fighting force. They were doing all right. But when the standard bearer took the standard and made a run for it, so did everybody else. Yeah. And the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may write them. In other words, the whole place is just going to be leveled. It's interesting too that the Babylonians, the Assyrians destroyed the gods of other nations when they took them over. The Babylonians assimilated them into their system as a means of controlling the population. Interesting, yeah. But the Jews didn't believe it was going to happen. Verse 12. I'll back to Habakkuk now. O Lord my God, my Holy One, you who are eternal, surely you do not plan to wipe us out. O Lord, our rock, you have sent these Babylonians to correct us, to punish us for our many sins. But you are pure and cannot stand the sight of evil. Will you wink at their treachery? Should you be silent while the wicked swallow up people more righteous than they? Are we only fish to be caught and killed? Are we only sea creatures that have no leader? We must be strung up by hooks and caught by their nets while they rejoice and celebrate. Then they will worship their nets and burn incense in front of them. These nets are the gods who have made us rich, they will cry. Will you let them get away with it forever? Will they succeed forever in their heartless conquests? That's a tough one, isn't it? How are the people going to feel that are left behind and see the main cities of both our countries destroyed? And do you know it's suddenly possible? It's actually quite interesting if you think about it. Up until a few years back, a very few years back, to destroy a city, you had to use a hydrogen bomb. And the problem with the hydrogen bomb, if you drop one on New York, for 50 miles all around, total devastation. And the ground, you couldn't go in there for ages. It was so radioactive. Now they've got nice little baby ones. Just pop and destroy a city. They're quite small. You can put 20 or 30 of them in the front of a rocket and send it over to, say, America. And when it gets to a certain part, the door opens and out they go, all pre-programmed. This one goes to New York, this one goes to here, this one goes to there, this one goes to there. Just destroys the city. 2 days later, you can walk in. No radioactivity. We really are good at wiping each other out. We really are. I mean, if they destroyed every city in America with hydrogen bombs, the country would be uninhabitable for centuries. Now we've got Habakkuk. This is chapter 2, verse 1. I will climb up to my watchtower and stand at my guard post. There I will wait to see the Lord, what the Lord says and how he will answer my complaint. Now, in the King James Version, it says, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower. I will watch. See, doing the same as we are doing today. I will watch to see what he will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reproved. He had been warned about the coming Babylonian army, and he was watching, waiting for it to happen, just as we are today. Habakkuk 2, verse 2. Then the Lord said to me, write my answer plainly on tablets so that a runner can carry the correct message to others. This vision is for a future time. You see, he's sitting out there waiting for this Babylonian army to come, when God's saying, no, this is for the future. 2,500 years in the future. It describes the end and it will be fulfilled. If it seems slow in coming, wait patiently, for it surely will take place. It will not be delayed. Now, in the King James Version, it's slightly different. It says, the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon the tables that he may run who reads it. Now, Bullinger says, when he quotes this, that he may run, he says that he that read it may flee. He says to run as a messenger. In those days, like I say, messengers were transferred from city to city by runners. And they literally ran, and they gave the message to the next guy, and he would run for so many miles. And, I think those guys got into the marathon running business. They'd have done really well today. That's all they did. Amos writing, just make a note of this to keep yourself in Habakkuk. Amos writing 150 or so years earlier, in Amos 3 verse 6, she says, shall a trumpet be blown in the city and the people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in the city and the Lord have not done it? Surely the eternal God will do nothing, but he reveals his secret unto his servants the prophets. God instructs Habakkuk to write the prophecy very clearly so that all can read it with understanding, so that they can flee, so that they can run. We need to be preparing for a disaster. Think about it. I used this many years ago. It was an article on aircraft safety. And they were saying that when a plane crashes, if you keep your wits about you, you stand a very good chance of surviving. And basically it said, be prepared. He says, when you get in the plane, just make sure you know where the exit is. Because when planes crash, they tend to fill up with smoke. So you crawl on the floor, three seats, turn right, and there's the door. He says, boring, yes, but the flight attendant's safety briefing may save your life. Just think of the parallels here with what we're learning in the Bible. Boring? Remain calm. Remain calm. It's as easy to get swept up in the pandemonium immediately preceding or following a crash. Keep a cool head. You'll need to be able to think methodically and rationally to maximize the chance. Get out of the airplane as quickly as possible. When the word's given, the door's open, you get out. It's critical to get out, without delay, you will generally have less than 2 minutes to safely exit the plane. After that, your chances are almost nil. Surviving a plane crash is very much down to your attitude, being informed, being prepared, and we are heading for the biggest crash in history. Think what's going to happen. We got advance warning of what's going to happen. Be prepared. The bride has made herself ready. Revelation 19 verse 7. Remember what Mr. Armstrong wrote in that PGR that we quote quite often in November the 20th, 1979. He gives 3 points that we need to take note of. One, talking about the end, what's going to happen? Apparently, it's when our work will suddenly end. Our work is on the internet. It can suddenly end within 24 hours. Boom. We would get 24 hours notice. Two, that will be a time when the united Europe shall appear, the resurrection, the revival of the medieval Holy Roman Empire. That will only happen out of a major, major, major crisis. And we know there's a major, major crisis coming. Virtually all the financial analysts know. Mr. Armstrong wrote about it years ago. That it's a civilization destroying financial crisis coming. And only out of that crisis will people accept a dictator. It says, we should be warned and readied to be taken to a place of refuge and safety from the great tribulation. What does that mean? We shall be warned and ready to be taken to the place of refuge and safety. We'll have to wait and see. But we can know that we will be warned. There's always a warning. We know where the exit is. We get God's warning on a weekly basis. We can study the Bible. We've got it all the time. We need to remain calm. Luke 21:20, we know very well when you see Jerusalem compassed by armies, flee to the mountains. Maybe that means we need to be in the right place at the right time. I don't know. We'll find out. Habakkuk was watching. He was alert. And verse 3, the vision is for a future time. How did he feel when he was told that? And here he is sitting on his watchtower waiting to see this massive army coming over the horizon that's going to destroy Jerusalem. And then he says, it's for a future time. It describes the end and it will be fulfilled. If it seems slow in coming, wait patiently, for it will surely take place. It will not be delayed. You know, God sent the prophets before Israel went into captivity. And if you check back, I've done a very brief study looking at the dates of the kings, then you check which prophets prophesied in the days of each of the kings. Roughly 80 to 100 years before the fall of Israel, the prophets were out there saying, it's coming. And the Judah also had the same thing. They were warned and warned and warned. It's getting on for that sort of time that Mr. Armstrong, 1934? Think about it. Verse 4 of Hebrews 2, Habakkuk 2. He says, look at the proud. They trust in themselves and their lives are crooked. But the righteous will live by their faithfulness to God. Now let's get that in King James Version because I think it reads actually better. Paul quotes this in Hebrews 10:37. For yet a little while, and he that shall come, and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. And then you've got 1 Corinthians 10, where Paul says, all these things happened in the Old Testament for our examples. We're supposed to learn from them. The warning went out before Israel was taken captive. For nearly 100 years, and the same with Judah, the warning's been going out for the last 80, 90 years, and we're almost there. We can see it starting to happen. The Bible's full of Matthew 24, verse 14. This gospel should be preached in all the nations before the end. We witnessed it. We were part of it. We were involved in it, some of us. It happened. Mr. Armstrong said it had happened, and he died. We then end up with 2 Timothy, Thessalonians 2 verse 3. Let no man deceive you. The end won't come unless there's a falling away first. We're living it, aren't we? We're living it. And every now and again we see some new wacky idea coming up. And we sigh and we think, why can't we get back to the faith that was once and for all delivered to the saints? Because it didn't come from Mr. Armstrong. It came from Jesus Christ. And that's the big thing. And these people that are going off track, they're going to have a rude awakening, a very rude awakening. Now, verse 5 of Habakkuk 2, they say, what sorrow. There's five woes here in the King James. The modern translation says, what sorrow, instead of woe. Basically, it's just an exclamation. Habakkuk 2, verse 5. Wealth is treacherous, and the arrogant are never at rest. They open their mouths as wide as the grave, and like death, they are never satisfied. In their greed, they have gathered up many nations and swallowed many people. Right this morning, I had a quick look at the news, and here's an article. Everyone has fallen for the lies about Venezuela. And I read on down, and it brings up the following point. Dropping the dollar. Iraq dropped the dollar. We invaded. It's written by an American. Syria dropped the dollar. We invaded. Iran dropped the dollar. We sure want to invade. Libya planned to drop the dollar. We invaded. Pakistan dropped the dollar in trade with China, and the US added them to the list of countries violating religious freedom. This is a pretty serious sanction in actual fact. He said, I guess you could argue they did indeed violate our religion, the dollar. Basically, we do not take kindly to countries dropping the dollar. Venezuela just dropped the dollar. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the known world. Foreign intervention in civil conflicts is 100 times more likely if the country has a great deal of oil versus none. So, who is feeding the average American the idea that our involvement in Venezuela is about helping people? That's what the news is full of now in America. Get the food aid down there. Somebody did a check. The first 5 aircraft that went down there were full of armaments. You don't eat guns. Only every mainstream media channel in America, from MSNBC to Fox News to NPR, Bill Maher, it's truly mind-numbing to watch so-called liberals march in lockstep with the likes of John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, Donald Trump, and every neoconservative not currently in a coma. That's what's going on right now. You could go home tonight and turn the telly on and see that America has attacked Venezuela. We were warned to expect a dramatic financial collapse before the end of the age, when all civilization would break down. Verse 6 of Habakkuk 2. But soon their captives will taunt them. They will mock them, saying, "What sorrow awaits you, thieves! Now you're going to get what you deserve. You've become rich by extortion, but how much longer can this go on?" Does that not describe the West today? Worthless currencies, overvalued stock markets, derivatives, or financial gambling is more like it. And that runs into several $100 trillion. If that market collapses, there'll be no financial system left in the West. Bank fraud, interest rate manipulation, and on and on and on and on and on. It seems a few months can't go by, and it's the latest Deutsche Bank, I believe, is the latest one that they're all jumping up and down on. The trouble is when you jump up and down on one bank, the two of the others all come out of the woodwork because they're all doing the same thing. Verse 7, suddenly your debtors will take action. They will turn on you and take all that you have while you stand trembling and helpless. How could the American nation pay back its debts of over $22 trillion? Just remember how much a trillion is. Yeah, $1 million in $100 bills you can put in a couple of supermarket bags. $1 billion you can stack up on a pallet 3 feet square, 3 foot high, that's $1 billion. $1 trillion is an acre plot covered in these pallets too deep. That's how much $1 trillion is. That's an awful lot of money. If they sold off, I think it was on the news the other day, if they could sell off the 500 top US companies at a fair price, they still would not have enough to pay the bill. Now that's a problem. Habakkuk 2 verse 8. Because you have plundered many nations, now all the survivors will plunder you. You committed murder throughout the countryside and filled the towns with violence. The US attacked Iraq and Libya because they wanted to stop using the dollar. What about Britain? You know, in the 1800s, we stripped India of several trillion pounds worth of assets. That's just one of our colonies that we had. You go up to some of these, look, go up to Liverpool, particularly Dock City, the money, look at the buildings there, some beautiful buildings. We couldn't even afford to design them like that today, let alone build them. The money was flowing. Some of these country estates, the bankers, I've been to some of them, several thousand acres, and it's all landscaped. Beautiful, absolutely stunning. To do it today, it would probably cost you several billion pounds. These people were filthy rich. They really were. But they did it because they literally thieved it from a lot of the other nations. Verse 9. What sorrow awaits you who build big houses and with money gained dishonestly? What about our friend, the global warming man? The name's just gone off me just now. Who? Al Gore. Mr. Al Gore. Right. Mr. Al Gore lives in a massive house that evidently uses about 5 times the electricity of a normal big American house. He flies around a plane that pollutes the atmosphere, etc., etc. And he's made about $100 and something million out of global warming. Now, wait for it, but next week in the update, we'll have a look at the global warming situation, because it really ties into all of this. There's fraud everywhere. Do you believe your wealth will buy security, putting your family's nest beyond the reach of danger? So many of these top people, the billionaires, what have they done? They've bought land in New Zealand, and they're building houses there, so that when everything goes bad in America and so on, they can jump in their Learjet or whatever, zip down there, and they can just continue the life of Riley. I suppose, a bit like that man in the Second World War, American who went to Midway. He looked at the map and said, there, middle of the Pacific Ocean. He was right in the middle of the biggest naval battle in history. And he survived just. Medway was just a fat slab of sand by the time they were finished with it. There's no place to hide. But the murders you committed, you have shamed your name and forfeited your lives. What about the American drugs industry that feeds people stuff to kill them? The very stones of the wall cry out against you, and the beams in the ceiling echo the complaint. It's almost like the whole civilization is groaning, as Paul wrote. It's groaning, waiting for the manifestation of the sons of God. Because we're going to be the answer to all this. What sorrow, verse 12, awaits you who build houses with money gained through murder and corruption? Has not the Lord of heaven's armies promised that the wealth of nations will turn to ashes? They will work so hard, but all in vain. For as the waters fill the sea, and the earth will be filled with an awareness of the glory of the eternal. Now, this is an interesting statement. It's repeated 5 times in Scripture. If you want to make a note of them, save time to read them all. Numbers 14:21. But as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. That's at the time when Moses was being faced up by the Israelites, and you brought us here to die type situation. David in the Psalm 72 verse 19, and blessed be his glorious name forever, and let the whole earth be filled with his glory. Isaiah had two goes at it, talking about the seraphim, I think it was in Isaiah 6 verse 3, and one cried unto another and saying, holy, holy, holy is the eternal of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory. So that's a prophecy. And then 11 verse 9, a vision of the millennium. They will not hurt nor destroy all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the eternal as the waters cover the sea. And the final one, of course, is Habakkuk 2, verse 14. You see, that message is the same all the way through the Bible, because God's got a plan. And it's working at it. It's working out. Verse 15. What sorrow awaits you who make at your neighbors drunk? You force your cup on them so that you may gloat over their shameful nakedness. But soon it will be your turn to be disgraced. Come, drink and be exposed. Drink from the cup of the Lord's judgment, and all your glory will be turned to shame. You cut down the forests of Lebanon. Now you will be cut down. You destroyed the wild animals, so now their terror will be yours. You committed murder throughout the countryside and filled the towns with violence. You know, it's impossible now to pick up the news every day in the papers. In fact, you get to ignore it now. Who got stabbed today in London? Who got stabbed? How many got stabbed? Because everything's bigger in America. They use guns there in schools and shopping malls and take out 10, 15, 20 people at a time. Lovely world. What good is an idol carved by a man or an image cast that deceives you? How foolish to trust in your own creation, a God that can't even talk. And today, I'm afraid to say, in the Western world, our God is our money, isn't it? Verse 19. What sorrow awaits you who say to wooden idols, wake up and save us. To speech the stone images you say, rise up and teach us. Can an idol tell you what to do? They may be overlaid with gold and silver, but they are lifeless inside. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let the earth be silent before him. God is not dead, and God has not gone away. That's what they'd like. That's what they'd like. But he hasn't gone away. And here's Habakkuk's prayer, chapter 3. I say this man is so human. But remember, this is Christ speaking. He just wrote it down. This actually is Jesus Christ speaking. I have heard all about you, Lord. I am filled with awe by your amazing works. In this time of our deep need, help us again as you did in years gone by. And in your anger, remember your mercy. He's seeing this army coming. What are we doing? We're seeing the resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire just around the corner. I see God moving across the deserts from Edom. The Holy One comes from Mount Paran. His brilliant splendor fills the heavens. He's describing here the second coming of Christ, isn't he? And the earth is filled with his praise. He comes, his coming is as brilliant as the sunrise. Rays of light flash from his hands where his awesome power is hidden. Pestilence marches before him. That's the great tribulation. Plagues follow close behind. When he stops, the earth shakes, and when he looks, the nations tremble. He shatters the everlasting mountains and levels the eternal one. He is the eternal one. Get it, people? You can't spiritualize that one away in modern terms. God is God. He is all-powerful. He is omnipotent. He's got a plan, and that plan's taking place, whether people like it or not. I see the people of Cush in distress and the nation of Midian trembling in terror. Was it in anger, Lord, that you did strike the rivers and parted the sea? Were you displeased with them? No, you were sending your chariots of salvation. You brandish your bow and your quiver of arrows. You split open the earth with flowing rivers. The mountains watched and trembled. Mountains being a symbol of nations, yeah? Onward swept the raging waters. The mighty deep cried out, lifting its hands to the Lord. The sun and the moon stood still in the sky. Heavenly signs. As your brilliant arrows flew and your glistening spear flashed, you marched across the land in anger and trampled the nations in your fury. Verse 13. You went out to rescue your chosen people and to save your anointed ones. Interesting. You crushed the heads of the wicked and stripped their bones from head to toe. Does that sound a little bit like Zechariah 14? Flesh being consumed off the body and eyes being consumed out of the sockets. Verse 14. With his own weapons you destroyed the chief of those who rushed out like a whirlwind, thinking Israel would be easy prey. You trampled the sea with your horses and the mighty waters piled high. If you look at some of the events in Revelation, I think there's going to be a fair number of tsunamis whirling around the world. You know, tsunamis are a wonderful way of clearing things up. They come in and all the mess goes with them. And the next thing is they all go out and they take most of the mess with them. Take most of the mess with them. It's the greatest way of leveling a civilization. You trampled the sea with your horses and the mighty waters piled high. I trembled inside when I heard this. My lips quivered with fear. My legs give way under me and I shook in terror. I will wait quietly for the coming day when disaster will strike the people who invade us. This is a bit like Daniel. You know, he kept on getting being visited by Gabriel. And on the one occasion he said, you know, I lay on my bed for several days. I couldn't move. The experience was so shocking. And here's his attitude. Verse 17. Even though the fig trees have no blossom, and there's no grapes on the vines, even though the olive crop fails and the fields lie empty and barren, even though the flocks die in the fields and the cattle barns are empty, yet I will rejoice in the eternal. I will be joyful in the God of my salvation. He was looking to the end result. He was looking, in actual fact, to the return of Jesus Christ, which is exactly what we're doing today. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes me as sure-footed as a deer, able to tread upon the heights. I found this very refreshing because I'm perhaps a bit more involved than most in that I've got to look through this wretched news every day. Most days I've got between 50 and 100 emails that come in from all over. People send it in. And there's nothing nice. There is not one thing nice. I can totally equate with when he's, you know, in the beginning there, when he just says, how long is this going to go on for? You know, it's awful. And I mean, my wife keeps on telling me, don't let it rub off on you too much. But you can't not. You can't not. I mean, you see the chicanery. You know, the thing in the paper this morning about a young lad of 16 who took this young girl and basically killed her, among other things. What kind of a mind? Oh, it comes out then. Oh, he was into computer games and drugs. Yeah. How many people in America are on drugs? Tens of millions. How many people here are on drugs? Frightening. Twisting the mind. In an age where Satan is wrathful and seeking to destroy God's work. And the minds of people are being destroyed. And because we see, I know I gave a ridiculous analogy one time. I said, you know what, if a big jumbo jet crashed at the end of your street, the first time it happened, you know, you'd be horrified. You'd stand there gawking at it. 2 weeks later, another one crashes in the same spot. And you walk on down the end of the street to see what's going on. And you think, hang on, it's 2 weeks. Do you know what we'd be doing in England? 2 weeks later, Ladbrokes would be taking odds on the time the third one crashed. In other words, we are going through aversion therapy. The world is going through the opposite. They are getting bombarded with so much rubbish that, oh, well, it's not here. It's not happening here. We've got brethren down in Plymouth. And this morning, somebody took a saber and started slashing out with people, and the police had to shoot him. Nice place. It's horrible what's going on in the world. They've got to arm teachers in the classroom so they can fight the pupils. You know, one of the things that boys need when they grow up, they need a male figure that they can link onto. Now, when I went to school, just after the war, I don't think we ever had a woman teacher in primary school. They were all men. There are men that come back from the war, have been trained as teachers. And the discipline was kind of like raw. But we had men. Yeah. Our PT teacher, when I got to secondary school, just before we went down to South Africa, he was ex-SAS. He was as hard as nails. A little tiny little guy. Today, they're all women. They're all women. Where does all this rubbish transsexual stuff come from? This lesbian and gay. Check the people who do the research. 90% of them are female. There's your problem. The minds are getting perverted and twisted. And it's horrible. And why aren't there men out there teaching our primary school kids? They're scared. A little girl falls over and you put your arm around her to comfort her. Whoa, you're out of it. 18 months, 2 years later maybe. Sexual harassment, blah, 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 and the guy's finished. So nobody wants the job. Nobody wants the job. Nowadays, you can't even look at some people without getting locked up. There's one the other day, a couple of builders saw this this guy dressed up as a woman or whatever and made a few comments, as builders probably would after a couple of pints of beer. And they got fined, what, £500 or something, and to give to pay them compensation because they hurt their feelings. They hurt their feelings. You know what God's going to do to them? He's going to destroy them. And then we'll resurrect them. Now you understand why the White Throne Judgment Period is 100 years. When you get people whose mind is so totally mixed up, they can't work out which sex they belong to. But I'll leave you this one example. Go back to Jeremiah 38. This really hit me between the eyes, and I think it bears repeating because I think it's so important. Jeremiah 38. You've got to think of the situation here with poor old Jeremiah. Spent most of his life either in prison or avoiding it, getting beaten up by the princes. They wanted to kill him, and the king wanted to protect him, and so on. And verse 17, and then said Jeremiah to Zedekiah, thus says the Eternal, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, if you will assuredly go forth unto the king of Babylon's princes, then your soul shall live, and this city shall not be burned with fire, and you shall live and with you and your house. But if you will not go forth to the king of Babylon's princes, then this city shall be given into the hands of the Chaldeans, and they will burn it with fire, and you will not escape out of your hand. He got a direct warning from one of the, shall we say, more famous of the Bible's characters, Jeremiah, who was used by God then to transplant the throne over to the UK, as we've seen in US and GB in prophecy. Had Zedekiah heeded Jeremiah's warning, not only would he have lived, who knows, Solomon's temple might have still been standing there when Christ returned. But he didn't. He would not obey, all because he felt somebody might mock him. How silly is that? There is, in print, and then he had to suffer the ignominy of standing there watching his entire family, all of his sons, one after the other, brought in front of him and killed. That must be the most horrifying experience any father could ever wish to see. I can't think of anything much worse than that. And then he put out his eyes. He had red hot iron in the eyes. That wasn't very pleasant. And then you're blind. And you're chained. And you're dragged through the streets as a showpiece. Yeah, we conquered this lot. Look at them. Romans did that as well. They used to put hooks in people's lips and other places in the body and make them walk through the street so they could laugh. These are our captives. So, in Habakkuk's day, if anybody had listened to what Habakkuk wrote, they could have packed their goods and left for other climes and survived. Had they listened to what Habakkuk was given, they could have got a couple of donkeys, loaded everything up, and off. Quite where they'd have gone, I don't know, but the point was they had a chance to escape. The New Testament church is interesting because there's quite a lot of information that 68 AD, Jerusalem was surrounded by armies. Just before then, the Christians evidently were told to get out and go to Pella. Now, Pella is basically, 15, 20 miles south of Nazareth. It's on the way to Petra. Those ones that went down there, they lived. They survived. Tradition has it that no Christians died during that siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, these are traditions, we don't know. At the end of the age, those at the end of the age who flee when they're told to will live. The rest will go into the tribulation. Think about it. Two scriptures in closing. Revelation 19, verse 7. I mean, again, we know this one very well. Revelation 19, verse 7. Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come and his wife has made herself ready. It's a mindset. This society is finished. It's doomed. It's all up for destruction in the next few years. We're seeing the signs there. The writing is on the wall. And it was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white. For fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. This time of the year reminds us that we have to be putting sin out of our lives, replacing it with righteousness. We put the world out. We put God's way in. Replace it with God's way. Because that's what we'll be teaching in the millennium. And if we're not striving to learn it now, how can we possibly teach other people? Oh, well, I used to do it this way, but now you guys have got it that way because it's in the Bible. That doesn't work. We've got to be living it now. And to the final scripture, let's turn to Luke 21. Luke 21, verse 36. Again, we know this scripture very well, but think about what it's actually saying to us personally. This is Jesus Christ speaking. Watch ye therefore. Watch. Be aware. Just as when the plane crashes, you know it's going to hit the ground. You know there's going to be a lot of smoke. But you know where the door is. You know you've got 2 minutes to get out. And you've prepared. You've prepared in your mind where to go and what to do. A lot of people have done this and a lot of people have lived. There's more people survive plane crashes, actually, than you might think. But you've got to be ready. You've got to know what to do. So we've got to watch. And then it says, and pray always. We've got to have that contact with God. You know, if we're approaching unleavened bread, Without that attitude, we are wasting our time. Because it's God that grants repentance. God's the one that's got to help us to change. You can't do it yourself. Our righteousness is as dirty rags. If you want to know what that is, check it up in the dictionary and you'll find out. We need God's help to do what we need to do. That's why we've got to be praying always to get that help, that we may be accounted worthy to escape all these things and shall come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. What God wants is he wants a people that are learning to think like he thinks, that want to become like he is, spirit, eternal. And that's where we're headed. But there's a lot of water got to go under the bridge, isn't there? So we just keep on going. And with God's strength, we can all make it. The final prize, if you want to call it, is beyond anything that we can actually comprehend. Can you imagine being able to solve some of these problems? To be able to help people for 1,000 years? That's what it's all about. So let's be at it. Let's be about our Father's business, as the Lord said.